Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is October 14th, 2020, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Somebody Get Me a Doctor! But Do I Need TXA by EMS for a TBI? And our guest skeptic is Dr. Salim Razai. He is a community emergency physician at Greater San Antonio Emergency Physicians, where he is the Director of Clinical Education. Salim is probably better known as the creator and founder of the wonderful knowledge translation project called Rebel EM. It's a free critical appraisal blog and podcast that tries to cut down the knowledge translation gaps of research to bedside clinical practice. No wonder we are such good friends, Salim. Great to have you back on the SGEM.
Absolutely, Ken. We've always been two peas in a pod, always trying to cut down that knowledge translation time. And look, I think it's great. The more of these projects we have out there that are free and open access and trying to help everyone who doesn't have time to read through this stuff, I think it's a better thing. And I think you and I have very similar philosophies when it comes to that.
I like that, two peas in a pod, but not to be confused with another podcast called Two Peds in a Pod. Well, I am loving seeing and hearing about your personal growth journey. If people have not been following this, go over to Rob Orman's Stimulus podcast. It's episode number 16, The Accumulation of Marginal Gains. Can you give us a little teaser of what that podcast was about?
Yeah, essentially, it was just basically change doesn't happen overnight. I think a lot of us kind of have this figment of our own imagination that I'm going to stop doing something today and it'll be different tomorrow. And really what we kind of focused on is this concept of aggregation of marginal gains, which is just get 1% better every day. And a bunch of 1%s every day over the course of a year really starts to add up. And you can use this in many aspects of your life. Diet, exercise, mental health, relationships, whatever you can think of. I won't go into all the details, but that's essentially what we focused on and talked about.
So it's like taking baby steps, small little incremental changes. And when you look back over time, you can make a big difference.
That's exactly it. And, you know, I think a lot of us draw this straight line of going from point A to point B. But as you and I both know, we've both made many mistakes in our lives. You learn from those mistakes. So there's a little bit of give and take. You take a couple steps back, you take three steps forward. It's not just this straight linear line. And that's kind of what we kind of got into, focusing specifically on health and diet.
Well, let's not focus in on our mistakes because that would be a long podcast. Let's talk about a case.
Let's do it. So a 42-year-old helmeted bicycle rider is involved in an accident where he hits his head on the ground. Now, at the time of EMS arrival, the patient's alert, but seems a little bit confused. The accident was within 1 hour of his injury, and his Glasgow Coma Scale, or GCS score, was about a 12. His vital signs showed a slight tachycardia, but otherwise, the rest of his vital signs were within normal limits. His pupils were both equal and reactive, and he doesn't appear to have any other major traumatic injuries or focal neurologic deficits. The only thing he may have is some small abrasions from the fall. Otherwise, nothing else serious.
Well, the CRASH II trial, published 10 years ago back in 2010, showed a 1.5% mortality benefit, which gives a number needed to treat of 67, for patients with traumatic hemorrhages who received tranexamic acid, or TXA, compared to placebo. Dr. Anand Swaminathan and I covered that on a classic episode, SGEM number 80.
And let's face it, TXA has become standard practice in many settings as a result of that trial. However, patients with significant head injury were pretty much excluded from that study, and it's unclear what the effect of TXA would be specifically in that group.
Fast forward to October 2019, 1 year ago, when CRASH III was published. This large, very well done, randomized placebo-controlled trial asked a very important question. Does the use of TXA in patients with traumatic brain injuries, TBIs, with a GCS score of 12 or lower, or any intracranial bleed on CT scan and no extracranial bleed treated within 3 hours, is that superior to placebo? The authors reported no statistical superiority of TXA compared to placebo for the primary outcome of head injury-related deaths within 28 days. And you and I reviewed that article published in The Lancet on SGEM number 270.
It was like a year ago. I mean, it's, man, blast from the past. It's like, this is our annual meeting. You know, we have our annual TXA meetup.
It's an anniversary for us. It's a TXA anniversary.
So, you know, you and I, when we looked at this paper, we kind of thought it was really well done, as you said. But then we looked at some of the subgroup analysis, and that showed maybe a little bit of benefit in patients who had a GCS of 9 to 15 and intracranial hemorrhage on their baseline CT when we looked at mortality. And we both kind of said the same thing. While this is very interesting, it's a subgroup secondary analysis, potentially could be clinically significant, but we have to be really careful to not overinterpret that because it was a subgroup analysis.
And I remember that podcast, and we did express some concern over the possibility that the subgroup showing benefit would be highlighted and, quote, spun. And unfortunately, that did happen with a subsequent media blitz and a misleading infographic.
So I would say further data is clearly needed. I think this is an important patient population, and we just need some more data to see if this is actually a beneficial medication for these patients with TBI.
So give the clinical question.
Does pre-hospital administration of TXA to patients with moderate or severe traumatic brain injury improve neurologic outcomes at 6 months?
And what's the reference?
Rowell, SE et al., effect of out-of-hospital tranexamic acid versus placebo on 6-month functional neurologic outcomes in patients with moderate or severe traumatic brain injury, published in JAMA 2020.
All right, Salim, you know we run through a PICO, so what was the population?
So these were patients that were 15 years of age or older with moderate or severe blunt or penetrating TBI. Moderate to severe TBI was defined as a GCS of 3 to 12, at least one reactive pupil, systolic blood pressure greater than or equal to 90 millimeters of mercury prior to randomization, able to receive the intervention or placebo within 2 hours from injury, and destination to a participating trauma center.
And there were a number of exclusion criteria, and I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
So really, we had two intervention groups. So there was the bolus maintenance group, which received an out-of-hospital TXA dose of 1 gram IV, and then subsequently an in-hospital TXA dose of 1 gram over 8 hours, like what we do for our trauma patients. The second intervention group was what they called the bolus-only group. And they received an out-of-hospital dose of tranexamic acid of 2 grams IV. And then when they arrived to the hospital, they received an 8-hour IV infusion of placebo.
And what did they compare this to?
So this is what they called the placebo group. And they basically said these patients receiving out-of-hospital saline as an IV bolus and then followed by an in-hospital saline 8-hour infusion, much like what we were doing for the intervention, except with saline.
All right, let's run through the outcomes. What was the primary outcome?
So their primary outcome was favorable neurologic function at 6 months, and they defined this as a Glasgow Outcome Scale extended score of greater than 4, which is essentially moderate disability or good recovery.
And how about the secondary outcomes?
So this was interesting. They state that there are 18 secondary endpoints, which there are, but really we only have 5 that reported statistical analysis in this trial. There was 28-day mortality. There was 6-month disability rating scale score. There was progression of intracranial hemorrhage, which they defined as greater than 33% increase in the combined volume of hemorrhage, incidence of seizures, and incidence of thromboembolic events.
Maybe the authors just knew that 5 was my favorite number, so that they had 18 secondary outcomes, but they wanted to just cut it down to 5 so we could do a review.
I mean, they knew that we were going to put our skeptical eye on this, and anybody who knows you, Ken, best number is number 5.
The author's conclusions were, quote, among patients with moderate to severe TBI, out-of-hospital tranexamic acid administered within 2 hours of injury, compared with placebo, did not significantly improve six-month neurologic outcome as measured by the Glasgow Outcome Scale Extended. All right, Sal, let's go through the 11 questions, because that's my second favorite number, quality checklist for randomized clinical trials. You ready to go?
Let's do it.
All right. Are these ED patients?
Yes and no. So obviously this was a pre-hospital study, but the patients ultimately ended up in the emergency department for completion.
Did they have adequate randomization?
I believe they did. This was a 1-to-1-to-1 randomization using computer-generated allocation sequence with out-of-hospital study drug kits packaged in numerical order according to a permuted block design of variable block size of 3 and 6.
Was the randomization process concealed?
I feel like they did a great job, yes.
The patients, were they analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized? In other words, did they do a pure intention to treat analysis?
Yeah, so this answer is going to be no. So they had 1,063 randomized, but only included 966, which is only 91% of the population included in the primary analysis.
So it wasn't a pure ITT. All right. The study patients, were they recruited consecutively?
I'm really unsure about this. They don't explicitly state it in the manuscript or in the supplemental material. I did try and find to see if that was what they did. I just couldn't find it.
Yeah, one of the things I do is I go back to the original study. It's in a PDF format. And then I start searching all patients, consecutive, consecutively, all those kinds of things. Then I go to their supplemental material to see if I can find it there. And sometimes I even go back to if the trial was registered to clinicaltrials.gov to see if it is consecutive. And I too couldn't find something explicitly stating that they had consecutive recruitment. The sixth question, the patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yeah, absolutely they were. They looked at several scores. They looked at injury severity, and it was similar between the groups. And they looked at out-of-hospital GCS score, they looked at the ISS score, and they looked at the AIS head score. And they were really balanced between groups.
The seventh question, were all participants unaware of group allocation?
Yes, the EMS agencies, the pharmacists, the coordinators, and the providers were all blinded throughout the study.
Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention?
I believe so, yes.
And was follow-up complete? And what we usually look for a quality metric, is at least 80% for both groups.
Yeah, so to be fair, when I initially answered this, I said yes. But then after talking with you, we changed it to unsure. And here's why we changed it to unsure. So it depends on what you define as lost to follow-up. If you use all patients randomized as the denominator, you get a 23% loss to follow-up. However, if you use the patients included in the primary analysis, which is what I did when I initially answered this question, then your loss to follow-up rate is only 15%. So it completely depends on how you define that.
And so what you're saying is it all depends. But it's not like if you don't lose 20%, that's a good study. And if you do lose 20%, that's a bad study. It's just something to keep in mind when you're looking at a study to interpret it. What was the loss to follow-up? 10th question. All patient important outcomes were considered.
I believe so. I really like their primary and secondary outcomes.
And the 11th and final question. Was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No, it wasn't.
All right, let's go through some of the results. They enrolled and randomized just over 1,000 patients, with just under 1,000 patients being included in the primary analysis. The mean age was in the late 30s. 3/4 were male. The vast majority, and what I mean by vast majority, was more than 90%. So that's a super majority of patients had blunt trauma, not penetrating trauma. Mean out-of-hospital GCS score was 8, and the mean time from injury to out-of-hospital study drug administration was just over 40 minutes. All right, Sal, what was the key result?
I mean, really straightforward. There was no statistical difference in favorable neurologic function at 6 months with TXA compared to placebo. And when we look at that favorable neurologic function at 6 months, it was 65% in the TXA groups because they combined those two together. versus 63% in placebo, with an overall difference of 3.5%, and a p-value of 0.16. So basically not statistically significant.
And we don't want to get too hung up on p-values, but that between group differences of 3.5% wasn't statistically significant. But I think we'll dig into that a bit more in the nerdy section. All right, how about secondary outcomes? They had five of them that you were going to go through. What was the 28-day mortality?
So again, no statistical difference, 14% versus 17%.
How about the disability rating scale score?
Also, no statistical difference between groups, 6.8 versus 7.6.
And then there was a progression of intracranial hemorrhage, and I think it was something like 33%.
Yep, of the total volume of the bleed in the brain, and basically no statistical difference between groups, 16% versus 20%.
Incidence of seizure?
So this was really interesting. The bolus only group, it was 5%. The bolus maintenance group was 2%, and the placebo was 2%. Now, this wasn't statistically significant, but worth mentioning.
And then one of the things that we're concerned about when giving TXA is thrombotic events.
Again, the bolus only group, 9%, bolus maintenance group, 4%, and placebo, 10%. Again, not really different between groups, just interesting data points to throw out.
And we did talk about these as percentages, and we need to be careful to talk about percentages, especially when the actual numbers are so low. And I don't mean the percentages are so low, the actual data points. It didn't happen that often that they had seizures or thrombotic events. So even though they may appear to have differences in percentages, like the bolus maintenance group got a 4% thrombotic event, whereas the bolus group only got 9%. That's a 5% absolute difference. That seems big, or more than double, but we're talking about small numbers, so we've got to be careful. But it sounds like I'm talking nerdy already, so hey, I'm going to sit back and say, Sal, it's time to talk a little nerdy. What do you got?
So let's start with survival bias. So this is basically when there's a selection process of a trial that favors certain individuals who make it past a certain point in time and ignores the individuals who don't make it past that point. In other words, patients who die shortly after the start of follow-up may not have had an opportunity to become exposed, and therefore we won't have their results recorded. So this introduces an artificial survival advantage associated with the exposed subjects, regardless of the treatment effectiveness. So when survivor treatment selection is not addressed, we can have ineffective treatments that may appear to prolong survival or potentially even worsen adverse events. So severely injured patients who survived longer in the bolus-only group, for example, may have lived long enough to experience more complications, and only those who survive out to the 6 months can have an outcome recorded.
Yeah, that's a really important point, and I'm glad you brought it up about survival bias. And I'll put a link in the show notes with some more information about survival bias. The second point we wanted to talk about was that Glasgow Coma Scale score. The GCS has limitations, including problems with inter-rater reliability. This could have contributed to the 20% or 1 in 5 of patients originally given a score of less than 13 in the pre-hospital setting, and then they arrived at the hospital with a GCS of 13 or greater. Another concern is that the GCS is not a diagnostic tool. It can't reliably discriminate between CNS depressed states such as intoxication, hypoglycemia, sedation, shock, seizures, and intracranial hemorrhages.
So nerdy point number three is something you already touched upon, which is few intracranial hemorrhages. And this trial ultimately had a small number of patients with intracranial hemorrhage, and I don't remember the exact number, but it's right around 50%. So half of that 966 patients had intracranial hemorrhage on CT. And so this means that many patients without intracranial hemorrhage were given TXA and were included in the analysis. While being practical, it could dilute any potential treatment benefit of TXA in patients with isolated TBI and without hemorrhage.
And we did mention point number four, so this will be a bit of spaced repetition, but this is talking about loss to follow-up. And depending on how you define this term and calculate loss to follow-up, it was at least 15% and could have been as high as 23%. Now, I usually get concerned when the loss to follow-up is greater than the difference in the primary outcome. This is more important when the authors are claiming superiority, which, I want to be clear, they are not doing in this case. The authors correctly do not conclude superiority. But that does not mean we should conclude that TXA, given pre-hospital, does not work in patients with isolated TBI. However, this trial does not support that TXA does work. But given the limitations we've discussed, it's still a reasonable hypothesis that TXA may work and merits further testing.
And the fifth and final nerdy point is one that I actually wanted to get into a little bit, which is talking about what is a clinically important difference. So we talk about statistical versus clinical significance. And so although the study was not powered to detect a difference in mortality, which, by the way, was one of the secondary outcomes, we see that it was around 3% for that difference in 28-day mortality. And again, I've already stated not statistically significant secondary outcome. But this could be clinically important at a population level. So if we make an assumption that there are about 56,000 TBI-related deaths per year in the United States, as an example, and I realize you're up in Canada, Ken, but I'm down in the US, a 1% difference would mean that we would have a decrease in mortality by about 560 cases per year. If we assume that this approximately 3% difference in this study, then we would get about 1,600 cases per year in the US that would be decreased in terms of mortality. Now, you brought up this point. Of course, this all totally depends if this is a true effect of TXA in these patients, but I still think it's worth bringing up. Sometimes it's not all about the stats. Sometimes we have to think about the clinical aspects as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And statistical versus clinical significance is an important distinction to make. And isn't it interesting that so much could hinge on one word that's only two letters, if this is a true effect size? And we don't know if that 3% is a true effect size, given the methodology in this paper. All right, let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SJAM's conclusion.
So I think we generally agree with the author's conclusions.
And how about an SJAM bottom line?
The routine use of tranexamic acid in the pre-hospital setting for patients with isolated or severe TBI cannot be recommended at this time.
And can you resolve the case you presented?
After evaluation of the patient, it is decided to not administer TXA pre-hospitally as the patient has an isolated TBI, no other traumatic injuries that would benefit from TXA, and with the lack of robust evidence to support its use in TBI in the out-of-hospital setting.
So how are you going to take this study on TXA and apply it clinically given the other studies that we know of?
Yeah, I think this trial of TXA versus placebo given within 2 hours of injury in the out-of-hospital setting in patients with moderate or severe traumatic brain injury, which we defined as a GCS of less than or equal to 12, combined with the results of CRASH 3, which was covered on SJEM number 270, and the TIC2 trial, which was covered on SJEM number 236, we just don't have any high-quality evidence to support the routine use of out-of-hospital TXA in patients suspected of having intracranial hemorrhage.
And again, I want to make the clear distinction that does not mean we're claiming it doesn't work. We have just not been convinced that it does work. And this is a really important distinction. So what are you going to tell the patient?
So what I would tell my patient is, you've had a head injury. We would like to admit you to the hospital for observation, neurologic checks, and ensure that there are no changes over the next 24 to 48 hours. The CT scan of your head that you had did not show any bleeding in the brain.
All right, time to announce the Keener Contest winner. And last week's winner was Dr. Daniel Mersch, a clinical assistant professor at the University of Buffalo. He knew tuna fish is a mnemonic to remember the red flags of low back pain. And I didn't plan this, but I have the creator of the tuna fish mnemonic on this SJAM podcast. So what does tuna fish actually mean, Salim?
Yeah, these are just looking for those red flags of back pain. These are a checklist for you to go through. It obviously doesn't cover everything, but T stands for trauma. U is unexplained weight loss. N is neurologic symptoms, as in focal neurologic deficits. A is equal to age over 50. F equals fever. I is IV drug use. S equals steroid use. And H equals history of cancer, specifically prostate, renal, breast, or lung.
And so if I come in with back pain, I've already got a red flag. I'm already a tuna fish because my age is greater than 50.
I've always known there was something fishy about you, Ken.
Oh, stop. All right, let's get to the question this week.
So I got to say, this is your question, and I absolutely love this question. So according to the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety in 2015, what percentage does the use of a bicycle helmet reduce your odds of head injury? Great, great, great question, Ken.
You see, I'm board certified in both family medicine and emergency medicine, and so I've got more firmly on my preventative medicine hat from being a primary care doc. And I know there's a lot of overlap, but, you know, wear a bike helmet, and there's evidence that you should wear a bike helmet. So I thought this would make a great keener question, because we're talking about head injury, that we could prevent them and promote preventative care by encouraging people to wear a helmet. So if you know what percentage the use of a bike helmet reduces your odds of having a head injury, then send your email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, there is some other FOMED information out there on TXA, and I'll list those in the show notes. But Sal, do we really have to do this only once a year, or could we get together more often?
Can we do this more often? I always learn so, so much every time we do this. I always send you a first draft, and it usually gets bled on, and I feel insignificant. And then, you know, I have so much fun hanging out. And obviously with everything that's going on with COVID, I feel like, you know, one of the hardest things you and I were talking about offline is the sense of isolation and not getting to see our good friends and really cherishing those friendships. So yes, can we please do this a little bit more often than once a year?
You do a fantastic job on the first pass, and you are a significant part of my wellness. So thank you very much for doing another episode with me.
Thank you for having me back on. And you know what? We're going to get you back on Rebel EM as well.
Ooh, I love being on Rebel. All right, so can you give the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.